Was your jazz background helpful to you as a rock drummer?
Oh, yeah. You know, if you had a hi-hat here, I'd show you. But nowadays, it's used all the time. And if you can envision a hi-hat, you know, coming together like this, you know, like that, the two cymbals.
Yep.
Well, you take a stick and you just hold it open a little bit and hit the outer cymbal on a downstroke and then close it. So it goes like that. Well, I'd heard that on a couple of jazz records a long time ago, you know, before the music machine, when I was a kid. And I used to use that all the time. And so when I put it on Talk Talk, everybody went, what the hell is that? And so all the, you know, drummers around town would be trying to play Talk Talk, you know, and none of them could do it because they didn't know all that stop, start type thematic things that I was doing with it.
So the
now everybody plays it, you know. I mean, you know, Blood, Sweat, and Tears and Chicago and, you know, all the funk stuff that came out, you know, that had a just, you know, it was just loaded with it.
So time-wise now, we're into 1966, right, when Talk Talk becomes a hit.
Yeah.
And immediately the label puts you on the road.
Yes.
How did you travel? Did you have a band vehicle or?
Well, we had a van.
A van?
Yeah. Okay. And a car, you know. It got us around. And we just drove, you know. Usually the trips were closer together on the West Coast. You'd go up to Redmond, California, and you'd do local trips like Lancaster and Bakersfield, and you know, then you'd head up north, you know, to Washington State, you know, Seattle and Everett, and you know, then come down back down again to Oregon and. You know, back down in California again. But basically, it was just West Coast, up and down.
When you went out to these places in different states, did the kids all know your song, Talk Talk?
Oh, yeah. It was a hit. Mm-hmm. It was a hit. It was number two or something in L.A. It was number 15 on the U.S. Billboard charts.
Right, it looks like it peaked at 15 on Billboard in December 1966. Mm-hmm. And let's see, Mark has an interesting quote here about Talk Talk. Once it got on the air, it took on a life of its own. And how about through the, let's see, I believe you also toured the South?
Yes. We toured the South a lot. Because there was work there. And we had a promoter down there, Eddie Arsenault, and he'd get us a lot of jobs down that way. Louisiana, places like Biloxi, Mississippi, and Baton Rouge, New Orleans, and then out in Florida, Orlando and Cocoa Beach. And we'd do these spring breaks and stuff. Mm-hmm. Wherever the promoters, you know, have us play, we'd do it, you know. Galveston, Texas, that was a big one for us. We do the armories, because you know why? They'd hold 1,500 or 1,600 people. And the promoters and you command more money.
I'm trying to imagine the average music fans in the South may not have seen a band wearing all black with black hair with a black glove and playing very aggressive rock and roll. Did that cause any problems?
No. We only got into some trouble in the Deep South, you know, Alabama, Birmingham. One time we were eating in a pancake house and we had some trouble with some good old boys up there, you know. Finally, the waitress stood up and got behind our back, you know, and said, hey, these guys were nice to me, and they gave me a nice tip, and da, da, da. And those guys out there, they're the ones who started it, and, you know, pretty soon the cops are getting the guys off the sidewalk, and, okay, you guys can go. you know, so we did, you know, we got out of some scrapes, you know, but we all had good hearts, you know. It wasn't that we were starting trouble or anything.
How about when you were performing, did you ever get any negative reaction when the band walks out on stage?
Well, yeah, you know, I'd walking down Hollywood Boulevard, we used to. But in terms of the clubs and that, we used to sometimes, Aspen, Colorado, we were up there one time and playing a job. And I remember Sean, there was a guy out there giving him some crap and stuff like that. And you know, Sean just kind of looks over to him and says something like, do we bug you when you're doing something out there? You know, why bug us? We're trying to do our job here. Mm-hmm. You know, I always used to tell people, I always say, how much money do you make? And he'd say, $75. And I say, that is not even close. You should do something like what we're doing.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Okay. And then they'd shut up for a while. But we weren't making any money either.
Doug's quote is that the Music Machine were perhaps the first long-haired people anybody had seen in some of those towns down south.
Well, that's correct. You know, we're the a lot of mop-top players there. You know, and very few the musicians who were actually playing like little trios and quartets and stuff. They were wearing long hair. But they weren't dyed and cut the way ours was, and you know they didn't. The black image was not there, and I remember we were playing this one place in Florida one time, and there's these guys up there in suits, and they were just playing some. It looked like a wedding jobbing band or something, you know. And I was standing out there, and I was just kind of digging what they were doing and that, and they were playing pretty good, and I just thought to myself, I hope I never wind up like that. And sure enough, I did. Because I did a lot of weddings, bar mitzvahs, and funerals up here, I'll tell you.
Did your second,
in the 80s.
Did your second 45 come out right away after the first 45?
Yeah, they tried to push People in Me.
Okay, how did that one do?
It did fairly well on the Billboard chart nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't have the power that Talk Talk did. Mm. And personally, I always thought there was one song on there on our album that we just kicked, and that was called Talk Me Down.
That was on the first album?
No.
This is on the reissue.
Yeah, that's why I want you to listen to that thing, because a lot of the stuff I'm alluding to here is really the essence of what the Music Machine did.
So you wanted Talk Me Down to be the follow-up?
I did.
45?
Yeah.
But you were overruled.
Yes.
By the record company or yeah. Sean? Or?
Well, the record company basically was in control of their own thing, you know. And there was some, you know, I was kind of on the outside of that whole deal. I wasn't being consulted all the time, you know, whatever I wanted to do. I was, 21 years old, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sean was considered the old man. He was 27. Talk Me Down was a natural.
You think it would have been a better follow-up to Talk?
Well, I'd beat on the table, but I know I'd just tear up your microphone here. But it was a really, if you listen to Talk Me Down, you can see the connection between the two. Even the name of it is.
So you're saying it's musically related.
It would have been a good. I would have been an excellent sequel to Talk Talk, without any doubt in my mind.
Okay.
It would have been a natural if I could. If I would have had control over that, and the drum part was just kick-ass on it. That's why I liked it, because it was so tough for me to do that. I worked like crazy in order to get that sound the way it did. And to me, that was the best follow-up we could have used.
And that was never released until the reissue?
No, it was... where did we do that? Talk Me Down. I think we might have even done that up at Art LeBeau's there, up in Original Sound. May have recorded that one there.
But never released in the 60s.
Oh yeah, it was released on the second album, I think, Beyond the Garage. It's on there, and of course the ultimate. And there was another record called Ignition.
So you go on this tour that starts in the winter of 66 and goes all the way through the spring of 67. What was it like being on the road for a long period of time?
Well, a simple explanation was you'd go out and you'd weigh 145 pounds and you'd look good. You know, I'd have a 33 waistline. And you'd come back and you'd weigh 128 pounds. And with pimples all over your face and $500 in your pocket. That's explainable enough. You burn yourself out. And you know something? These record companies were not walking around with their hands up in their air as to say, hello, I'll take care of you. I'll buy you a couple of salads and we'll take you to this, you know, feed you good. There's no way. They weren't around. Basically, you took care of yourself, you know. When you're young like that and you don't eat right and you sweat a lot and you're working yourself every day. But I'll tell you one thing. That's where I really learned how to play, was on the road. And when you come off the road like that and you go in the studio, you can hear the difference. Yeah. I mean, I could do finger rolls and I could play single stroke rolls just like, if I beat on the table here, I could show you, but I don't want to screw up your microphone like I said before.
You talk about a kind of a plan you guys had.
Yes.
When you were on the road, usually playing the top billing, so there'd be one or two bands before you.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on your plan when you played live? You stayed here. We were always under control.
That's right, yeah. You see, what happens a lot is you'll get a couple of bands, at least back in those days. I can only speak for our situation. And what would happen is we'd go to a place like Galveston, Texas, and play an armory. I remember that one for sure. And you'd have a little rehearsal room or something where you could maybe, you know, they never fed you or anything like that, like they do nowadays and everything, you know, like that. And you get on stage and you look around, you say, well, there's a sound system here. We got this and we got that. And meanwhile, you're checking out the other bands and stuff like, you know, finally you're to the place that, you know, both bands play before you, right? And as they're walking off, they're giving you the finger, and they're telling you that you guys suck, and you know all this other stuff, you know, like that, because they never heard you play live, you know, that all you heard is one record, and then they would hear you play Cherry Cherry, and then they would hear you play Taxman and 96 Tears, and oh, that's just a copy of the da da da. So they had this mindset, right? Well, then they tear their equipment down. I'd set up mine, and guys would tune up their instruments, everything, and the first chord, I'll tell you, every one of those guys were at the foot of the stage, and they're watching. A lot of them were watching me, because how do I play that drum part, you know? So they're, you know, I'm looking at them, and I know they're looking at me, right? So I just loved to kick their asses musically, like I mentioned before. So I was really focused, you know, and I'll tell you, by the end of the night, they were loading our equipment in the back of the place in our van.
Did you save Talk Talk for a strategic place in the set, like the end of the first set or the opening song, or
did you? If we did one set, because of all the other bands being there, we'd do it last, yeah. So this is what you came for here, and you know, wham, hitting like that, and they just loved it. Sometimes you could see that they're getting kind of antsy, you know. So you play it mid, and then you play like People in Me, the second, and then maybe Double Yellow Line. Some tunes were easier to play, some a little harder. Masculine Intuition was a good little tune. There was a few more that were really good. We really played well live. And we always, whenever we recorded anything, we would always try to make sure that if we transferred that sound live on stage, it would sound the same. So when we arranged a song, just in the little parts of it, like when you use a tambourine, when you use dynamics, let's say in cymbal parts and stuff like that, sort of creating the sound that starts slowly and then just starts building, and the excitement never stops. The other thing that we tried for a while was segueing every song without stopping in between.
No space.
But our guitars got so out of tune that we didn't have those fancy tuners and stuff on the floor and all this other technical stuff that you could just walk over while you're playing and, you know.
So you got a sponsorship with the Vox equipment?
Yeah, we did, yeah.
How'd that work out?
Well, the guys did. I didn't get any drums. There wasn't any Vox drums back in those days, but and I had mine, and I wouldn't have played on that crap anyway. But those amplifiers, those Super Beetle amplifiers, were just junk. They would smoke and carry on.
Actually, smoke would come out of them?
Oh, definitely. You'd burn out the speakers. That'd be one thing first. The speakers would go, because they were crap, and they'd actually start smoking. You turn them up to 10 or 9, they couldn't handle it, you know. And I remember Mark Lannon, he used to carry along a Fender Twin with him and hide it behind the Super Beetle. And I remember one night we were doing this really big show at the, I think it was the Los Angeles Civic Center. And, I mean, everybody was there, the Doors, the Turtles, Buckinghams, everybody was there, And all of a sudden, that Super Beetle started acting up and cracking and carrying up. As you were playing it, And Mark he'd turn around and he'd go, roll his eyes like this, I was just laughing at him, He finally, he used to plug in, he had another cord that he used to lay on the floor like that. He literally kicked the Super Beetle over on its side, plugged into the Fender, and he was real quick about what he used to do all the time, and just turned that Fender Twin up to 10, and we just rocked it all night long.
I'm not sure, but is the Super Beetle a reference to the Beatles?
Well, they just named it, I suppose. It was an English amp,
Okay.
It was a big, round type thing with handlebars on it, like around here like this, It was just awful. Now they have, this little Vox 30 amp, cost about $1,000, but it's a nice lamp from what I understand. But back in those days, they didn't make very good amplifiers.
Now, part of your tour included a stop in 1967 at the Winter Carnival in St. Paul.
Oh, yeah.
With the Blues Magoos.
Yeah.
What do you recall about that?
Yeah. Well, we got there. It was about 2 feet of snow on the ground, pulled up, and we were kind of late to actually come down because the weather was bad. Blues Magoos were on stage, and they were, dancing around and stuff, and kids liked it and that, and they were playing and that, and so we got up there and set up my stuff, and I didn't, most of the places that whenever you would play, they'd have a rug, for the drummer. That was just like common, I do it to this day. I throw one in the truck whenever I play, just so that if they're stupid and they don't put a rug down, not knowledgeable enough to know that a drummer's going to play here, then I'll have my own, right? Well, there wasn't one up there that day, so I thought, well, I'm in trouble here now so I took off my rubber mounts off of my spikes off of my bass drum, and I sunk them in there. And if I would have had a nail and a hammer, I would have nailed it to the ground. But I was sliding all over the stage. I was constantly pulling my drum set toward me when we were playing. But and there are some that even remember us before we started, that we weren't facing the people. We had our backs to the people, and we just turned around when we started.
Was that something you did on a regular basis?
We used to do all kinds of crazy stuff just to get attention to the band before we play. I remember one time when the tune was over and we were late, I talked to Sean just before the show, and I said, listen, I'm going to do something real crazy here toward the very end, but you guys just leave the stage. And, to isolate yourself like that in front of 1,600 people took a lot of guts, I'll tell you. But I had an idea.
Was this at the carnival?
No.
This is different.
No, this is different. This is at the Hullabaloo. I did that. Okay. But do you want me to keep talking about that?
Let's finish up this carnival. So
They roped the stage off there to make sure that the kids didn't jump up on the stage and steal our stuff, And so we played our show. My parents were there, and my brother-in-law, and all that. And it went really well. I got a nice write-up in the paper. They said the music machine upstages the Blues Magoos, and then they went on to it played this and it played that, but the music machine definitely was the act of the da 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 blah blah blah. And they went on and on and on. I still have I sent Sean Bonnywell for his biography book, a actual newspaper from the Strip. About that. That was one accurate thing. My mother or something remembered, mothers do that, I guess. They save stuff,
When you came here in the 67, was it a little known obscure fact that both you and Keith were from here?
I don't think anybody really knew. We were known as a West Coast band, definitely.
Right. Right.
I mean, when you're on Dick Clark's American Bandstand, and that's not in Minneapolis, I mean, you see where the action is on a beach. Well, that's not Minneapolis. You get the impression that it's a West Coast band,
Right.
And of course it was. But two of the members were born and raised here, myself and Keith. But the Blues Magoos, they were good and good band and everything. But again, we just had a very tight group. It was should have heard it live. It's awesome.
Is there an audio tape of that anywhere?
I don't know. Maybe somebody does.
Maybe somewhere.
Has some quarter inch reel to reel, maybe.
So you're talking about some ways the music machine would do certain things to differentiate themselves, and one of them you mentioned at the carnival was having your back towards the audience.
Yeah.
And then you started talking about another concert where you were playing alone.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And what had happened is that we all got done, and they had left the stage, so they decided that they were going to take my instrument from me. This is Keith, and everybody started unloading. Took my hi-hat, took it off the stage, and came back, got my cymbals, took them, grabbed my floor tom, walked off with that. And I was playing the whole time. Started out on a full drum set, right? And then they took that, so I just started on a different instrument and started playing that. And all I had was my throne and my snare drum by the time the whole thing was done.
Was that something planned in advance?
So then they grabbed my snare drum, right? And I didn't have anything to beat on, right? So I started playing on my knees. And then I finally just stopped, and I looked at myself, and I thought, what the hell am I doing? So I threw my drumsticks out there, grabbed my throne, and walked off the stage.
Was that impromptu, or was that planned?
It was impromptu, yeah.
Really?
They knew what I was up to, so they thought they would just go along with it. Mm-hmm. It was fun, though. That was a lot of fun. We used to do fun things like that all the time, just to create excitement.